The headlines: Iran says United States needs to commit to clear action steps if it genuinely wants an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal. North Korea's leader heats up the rhetoric against the U.S. in a speech on the Korean War Armistice anniversary. And dozens of former American officials are planning to form a third political party to break the bipartisan dominance of U.S. politics. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign minister has reiterated Tehran's determination to reach a good and durable agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Amir Abdullahian said a good agreement would be at hand if the American side took realistic steps in that direction. Iran's top diplomat said, if the U.S. is really willing to clinch a deal with Iran, it must prove this in practice. Amir Abdullahian also touched on Borrell's proposed text for an agreement to revive the JCPOA, saying that Iran welcomes continuation of talks and diplomacy. Borrell, for his part, said the Iranian side has so far proven its serious resolve during the JCPOA revival talks, and it's time for those talks to bear fruit. This came a day after Borrell wrote in a Financial Times article that he has put on the table a draft agreement to revive the JCPOA. He said the proposed text addresses the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and some other remaining differences. Masoud Shajid, a head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says the West should not expect Iran to fulfill its JCPOA commitments if it cannot reap economic benefits of the deal.
The reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position to actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit-for-tat, and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment, so Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
Now to Ukraine, where the Russian military has taken the country's second-largest power plant. Ukraine has confirmed the capture of the plant in the eastern Donetsk region, calling it a tiny tactical advantage for Russia. Kiev also says that Russia is redeploying its troops to three southern regions, Melitopol, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. An advisor to the Ukrainian president says a redeployment seems to be a switch from offense to strategic defense. Ukraine has already said it intends to recapture Kherson, which fell to Russia in the early days of the war. The country also says its forces have killed dozens of Russian troops in the past 24 hours. The Ukraine war is now in its sixth month. Well, Ukraine says it will increase electricity exports to the European Union as the bloc faces an energy crisis triggered by reduced gas supplies from Russia.
We are preparing to increase our electricity exports to consumers in the European Union. Despite the war, we secured the connection of the Ukrainian power grid to the entire European energy system in a record time. Our exports allow us not only to generate foreign currency revenues, but also help our partners withstand Russian energy pressure.
Zelensky added that his country will become one of the guarantors of European energy security. The Ukrainian power grid was connected to the European network in mid-March. The connection enabled Ukraine to receive electricity from Europe if military attacks caused outages. In early July, Ukraine started exporting electricity to the EU via Romania. On Wednesday, Germany said Russia has cut gas deliveries to Europe via the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of capacity, down from 40%. EU countries accuse Russia of reducing gas supplies in response to Western sanctions imposed on Moscow over the Ukraine war. Moscow, however, blames technical issues with the pipeline for gas supply cuts.
Up to a quarter of the EU's electricity demand is generated using gas. In some of the bloc's member states, it is higher. As less of it arrives from Russia, EU nations have agreed to reduce gas consumption by 15% until spring.
I think at the end, everybody understands that this sacrifice is necessary. We have to, and we will share the pain.
Many in the European Parliament say the pain is not being shared equally.
Only working class people are dying, but the EU has done nothing to stop us. And so many people in here are glad the war has taken place.
Within NATO, there is opposition to Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance. Within the EU, there is opposition to the bloc's foreign policy towards Russia. There are also tensions between the EU and the UK.
At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess.
It has been suggested that Russia wants Western allies to fall out.
Now is not the time for finger-pointing. We understand that they want to destroy, they want to divide, they want to split this solidarity and unity.
Critics say the West is responsible for the war in Ukraine because Russia's security concerns were ignored and even preyed upon. Experts suggest the conflict has highlighted the EU's weaknesses and has exposed the lack of energy infrastructure investment within the bloc.
That is why investing in grids, in interconnectors, in something as boring as pipelines, that matters.
Ordinary people in the EU are asking, how did we get to this point? There is a cost of living crisis and all sorts of security concerns. Analysts warn there will be political ramifications. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says his country is ready to mobilize its nuclear war deterrent and is prepared for any military clash with the U.S. Kim was speaking at an event marking the 69th anniversary of the Korean War armistice. He also warned that South Korean administration and military could be annihilated if it makes what he called dangerous attempts. Kim's speech came after Seoul and Washington said that Pyongyang had completed preparations to conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. South Korea also said the North could face more sanctions if it conducts the test. North Korea says the nuclear program is for self-defense against threats posed by the U.S. and its regional allies. Pyongyang is particularly opposed to joint war games by Washington and Seoul.
South Korea will soon resume large-scale military exercises with the United States. Seoul's recently appointed foreign minister Wednesday met with the foreign press and explained the importance of the U.S. alliance in the drills.
We expect that the Ministry of National Defense will resume training to maintain the South Korea-U.S. combined defense capabilities so that South Korea's security can be maintained.
The South Korean envoy placed the responsibility for subsequent military tension on North Korea.
North Korea's nuclear and missile development and provocations are the most important causes of tension on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea recently resumed ballistic missile testing after a self-imposed moratorium aimed at negotiating a lifting of U.S.-led sanctions, which remain in effect. Meanwhile, South Korea's further developed and tested missile technology and deployed several advanced U.S. weapon systems, raising concern in Pyongyang.
The U.S. and its allies are increasing their military pressure on our republic. All this is raising serious concern that the ravages of the war 72 years ago could be repeated here. Our measures to build up national defense capabilities are the legitimate and righteous exercise of our sovereignty to defend our national security and territory against military threats.
South Korea said this year's drills will include 11 field exercises, amphibious operations, and an air carrier strike group. South Korean officials have said the joint military exercises with the U.S. will begin on August 22nd, and for the first time since 2018, include field training. As new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol pivots to a hardline approach to Pyongyang, inter-Korean ties appear destined for greater tension. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Dozens of former U.S. officials, both Republican and Democratic, are going to announce a third national political party. They say the new party will appeal to millions of voters dismayed with the country's, quote, dysfunctional two-party system. The new party called Forward. will initially be co-chaired by a former Democratic presidential candidate and a former Republican governor of New Jersey. The founding members hoped the party would become a viable alternative to the Republican and Democratic parties. The new party is being formed by a merger of three political groups that have emerged in recent years as a reaction to America's increasingly polarized and gridlocked political system. A Gallup poll last year showed a record 2/3 of Americans believed a third party was needed. No information has been released on policy of the party, which will be centrist. Academic and political analyst Alexander Ozdagon says many American politicians are corrupt no matter whether or not a third political party comes into existence in the country.
In the 2016 election, Trump got around 63. I'm rounding the numbers up. Around 63 million votes, and Hillary got 66 million. So more important than third parties or fourth parties is how our politicians, corrupt, many of them, like you said, in the pockets of lobbies, how our politicians would somehow, maybe not this time, but definitely a priority in the future, to come up with some kind of a constitutional amendment to get rid of this gerrymandering, which results in this outdated and to some extent racist electoral college system. And just like the rest of the so-called democratic world, we go into a popular vote system. Now, if that happens, the Democrats will win. Kierkegaard said, the Danish philosopher, that life must always be lived forward, but it can only be understood backward. Let's not forget, Al Gore got 500,000 more votes than George Bush in the 2000 election. And imagine if Al Gore became the president. I mean, 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, everything would have been possibly different. And Hillary got 3.5 million more votes in 2016, but because of the electoral college system, it didn't count.
Two former U.S. police officers have been sentenced to prison terms for their roles in the May 2020 killing of an unarmed African American. A U.S. district judge sentenced J. Alexander Quang to 3 years in prison and Tu Thao to 3.5 years. The two officers were convicted of violating George Floyd's civil rights by failing to stop the use of, quote, unreasonable force by another officer, Derek Chauvin. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes until he passed out and died. He was found guilty of murder and is serving more than 20 years in prison. The fourth officer was also convicted of violating Floyd's civil rights and was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. A video of Floyd handcuffed and pleading with Chauvin for his life prompted outrage. In the days after the incident, Floyd's death led to huge daily protests against racism and police brutality in cities around the world. When it comes to U.S. weapons sales, it's not just about profits. Washington's foreign policy initiatives should also be counted, as can be seen in its deals with countries in West Asia. But the U.S. aggression against China is another reason which may explain why it's planning to sell almost $1 billion worth of arms to Japan and Singapore.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is set to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Washington's policy towards Beijing has taken a military turn. Hot-button issues like Taiwan, trade war, and the disputed islands in the South China Sea are examples of such tensions, and it's widely believed that the latest U.S. arms sales to countries in the East Asia region are to counter the influence of China, but the real question is whether these countries are on board the U.S.'s aggressive push against China.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region. With major advances in missile technology, naval forces and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries. China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. At the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020, the UK Health Department gave the first contract worth £133 million to healthcare firm Randox, without allowing any other firms to bid. The British government has suspended normal rules for awarding contracts as the pandemic was deemed to be an emergency. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Rob Evans, David Pegg and Felicity Lawrence. The piece is titled, UK Health Department Played Fast and Loose When Awarding COVID Contracts to Randocks. Please stay with us for more. The head of the UK Parliament's spending watchdog has said ministers and government officials played fast and loose when awarding £777 million in COVID contracts to a healthcare firm that employed the Conservative MP Owen Paterson as a lobbyist. In a damning report, the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee concluded that the government made a series of failures, making it impossible to know if the contracts had been awarded properly to Randocks. The Cross-Party Committee of MPs found that the Department of Health and Social Care did little to deal with potential conflicts of interest, despite clear concerns about Randocks' political connections. It added that officials were aware that Paterson had been in direct contact with Matt Hancock, who was then the Health Secretary, while promoting Randocks. The MPs found that Randocks made substantial profits after it was given the contracts to carry out COVID testing during the pandemic. According to the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee, which questioned whether they were excessive, the firm's profits in the year to June 2021 were more than 100 times greater than the previous year. In its latest accounts, Randocks reported a profit of £177 million for the year to 30th of June 2021. The MP said this compared with a profit of just £1.2 million that Randocks reported for the 18 months up to 30th of June 2020. A Randocks spokesperson accused the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee report of being deeply flawed and wrong in assumptions it makes and the conclusions that it draws, and added the firm had issued a legal complaint. He claimed at no stage, either during its deliberations or in its preparation of this report, did the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee make any contact whatsoever with Randocks. Consequently, many elements of its report relating to Randocks are false, based as they are on wrong and unchecked assumptions about the company. A spokesperson for the company has previously claimed that Randocks contracts were awarded in full compliance with government procedures and protocols in place at a time of the emerging pandemic. House of Commons Public Accounts Committee also concluded that the Health Department did not keep proper records of why it gave the contracts to Randocks, nor of what happened when ministers met the company. The department was approached for comment. The publication of the report comes after Randocks and Paterson were accused of cronyism in parliamentary debates. Randocks paid Paterson, then MP for North Shropshire, £100,000 a year. The former cabinet minister was forced to resign from Parliament last November when he wrongly used his parliamentary position to lobby for his clients, including Randocks. Evidence of his lobbying had originally been uncovered by The Guardian. The Liberal Democrats won the subsequent by-election, and the lobbying saga, including attempts by Boris Johnson to force his MPs to change the rules to protect Paterson, contributed to fury within the party and among voters, which ultimately led to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's downfall recently. Between 2010 and 2018, Randocks donated £160,000 to the Conservative Party. During the pandemic, Paterson directly lobbied Hancock on behalf of Randocks. After Paterson's lobbying, Matt Hancock chased his officials, saying he was very worried about how his department was treating Randox and other firms. The House of Commons Public Accounts Committee concluded that the department's woeful and poor record-keeping means that we cannot be sure that all these contracts were awarded properly. Even allowing for the exceptional circumstances at the start of the pandemic, basic civil service practices to document contract decision-making were not followed. It said that the Health Department neglected to scrutinize obvious conflicts of interest when it awarded the contracts, even though officials knew of Owen Paterson's contacts with Matt Hancock. Between January and October of 2020, Owen Paterson and Matt Hancock exchanged messages 8 times over private email or WhatsApp while the MP promoted Randox. Matt Hancock has claimed he did nothing wrong. The MP said officials were also aware that Matt Hancock had received hospitality from Randox in 2019 when he stayed overnight at a country estate owned by the head of the firm. Matt Hancock said he did not need to publicly declare this hospitality. The UK Health Department was also criticised for failing to meet the basic rule for publicly declare meetings between ministers and outside firms. Only 4 out of the 8 meetings between Randox and health ministers were made public, as they should have been. Records of what was said at only 2 of these meetings were kept. At the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020, the Health Department gave the first contract worth £133 million to Randox, without allowing any other firm to bid. The government had suspended normal rules for awarding contracts as the coronavirus pandemic was deemed to be an emergency. The House of Commons Public Accounts Committee said the award of this contract did not received the scrutiny we would expect from the department's senior civil servants. The role of the department's ministers in approving the contract was also confused and unclear. The MPs added, Randox struggled to deliver the expected level of testing capacity against its first contract, which did not set out any performance measures. Yet the department still awarded Randox a contract extension worth £328 million 7 months later, again without any competition. Meg Hillier, the House of Commons Public Accounts Committee's chair, said, "We repeatedly hear the reference to the crisis we were facing as a nation, but acting fast doesn't mean acting fast and loose." She added that much of the business was won without any competing tenders from companies who may have had better capacity to deliver, pointing out that Randox had also been given money to pay for equipment to conduct the testing. A spokesperson for Matt Hancock said Randox was Britain's largest testing provider. Not to work with them during this unprecedented global pandemic would have been a dereliction of duty.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We'll be right back.
things are heating up again between the U.S. and China. Not that it ever cooled down, but this time China has issued a stern warning to the U.S. It involves the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's planned visit to Chinese Taipei, though not confirmed yet. China says it may have to react militarily. Why would China react to this visit to this degree? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the China-U.S. tensions. Any questions as to why the U.S. is carrying out provocations? We'll be addressing that from Ukraine to West Asia and then to Asia itself. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Quindo Zhu, senior fellow at Pangol Institution, joins us from Beijing. We also have William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joining us from Leesburg of VA.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. William Jones, first over to you. Getting a mixed message in terms of the way the warning has come out. Just a couple days back, we had a warning that said that from China, that if this visit is going to take place, and this warning was supposedly done in private, that there may be a possible military response from China. Now it's not reflected so much in the news, aside from China saying that Washington would bear the consequences if this visit, which is not confirmed yet, were to take place. What's your reading into this?
Well, the warning still holds. It was made, it was done, and they're waiting really for a response. And the response will be either that the trip is somehow canceled or it takes place. And at that point, we will know what the response is, but there hasn't been any ambiguity on the part of the Chinese with regard to how they would react to this thing. This is a serious provocation. It undermines the three communiques. It seems to be, as China interprets it and as most people would see it, a step in the direction of moving away from the three communiques and supporting directly or indirectly China's Taiwan independence. And of course, that's a red line. And so if Pelosi does take this step, I think there will be a very strong reaction. What it will look like is still difficult to say, but I think China cannot not react to this, except that they would accept a greater provocation in the direction which they do not want to go.
Kendo Zhu, one of the responses that came from the Chinese Ministry of Defense, and it was reported in a private call with the U.S., signaled that there could be a military response. And along those statements, quote, if the U.S. insists on taking its own course, the Chinese military will never sit idly by. Do you think that if the trip takes place, many analysts say that's not going to happen, a military response from China. Do you think there will be one or not?
There will be one for sure. There's no doubt about that. It's really about what kind of a military action the Chinese side would take. The people are guessing that the likely choice would be, you know, escorting, you know, the plan of Nancy Pelosi and force it to change direction. And the Chinese side will not allow the landing of Nancy Pelosi's plan in Taiwan. So in that sense, you know, basically forcing the United States to respect and what it has promised is a commitment to the One China principle. You know, in 1979, when China and the U.S. established the diplomatic ties, the foundation, one of the most important foundation, is that it severed the relationship with Taiwan, Republic of China at that time, and establish the relationship with the People's Republic of China. It acknowledges, you know, Beijing is the sole legitimate representative of China, and Taiwan is part of China. And by sending Nancy Pelosi, an official with such a high seniority, that's a serious break or violation of the One China principle that I will undermine the political foundation of the relationship between Beijing and Washington. So China will have to move against that visit, you know, in whatever way. And one of the serious choice is really the military choice here. And there's basically no way for China to step back, even one inch, I would say. So, China will respond forcefully and with the military airplanes.
Well, just to make sure that we understand this angle of it correctly here, I'm going to ask you this, William Jones. When you keep reading in the reports that they describe Pelosi as a Democrat who is second in line to the presidency, are they meaning that if there was to be, well, there is this notion of a military response, that therefore, because of her position, that would pose a national security risk? Is that why they keep mentioning Pelosi in that context?
Well, the reason that Pelosi is significant, not just a congressman going to Taiwan, the Speaker of the House is a part of the U.S. government. It isn't part of the executive branch, but it is an official part of the legislative branch. So that she would have to adhere to the policies of the government, which were accepted by the executive branch as well as the legislative branch. The One China policy is government policy. And so given that position, of course, this means that a high-level U.S. government official is breaking with that One China policy. In Pelosi's case, she's not the second, but the third in line for the presidency, which also puts her in, you know, in a direct line with potentially executive functions, which makes it even more serious. So by doing this, and people are aware of this, and Pelosi is, of course, aware of this as well. And she and other people are intent on trying to push this Taiwan issue to try and, they think, contain China. But what it could effectively do is lead to a military conflict with China. And that's why you have seen the reaction from the Pentagon, which is certainly not pro-Chinese, but they have said, look, we don't like the fact that she would be doing this, because they realize that China is going to react, that they could suddenly find themselves in a military conflict with China simply because Pelosi decided to go on this trip. The White House has also reacted. Biden communicated the Pentagon's concerns to Pelosi. It's difficult to say. It probably divided opinion within the White House itself, but I think there should be a certain amount of concern with regard to this as well. But they officially do not have the role of being able to tell Pelosi what to do because of the division of powers in the U.S. government. But if they were assertive enough, they could make it very clear that they didn't want her to go, and they could effectively stop this, I believe. Whether they would do that or not, I'm not sure.
Well, Kendo Zhu, before I turn to you, I had to take a glance over at the clock to find out how much time we have to look at the different ways that the U.S. disagrees with China on so many issues. I'm not too sure we could fill all of those in. But let's take a look at one of the most recent developments, unless you have one that comes off the top of your head. Go ahead.
No, it's really, I want to point out that, you know, you can ask the question about this probably very likely upcoming visit to Taiwan. That is, we say, provocative. And also you can ask the question, we say, it's unnecessary provocation or unnecessary crisis in the making. You can ask for what is the purpose of Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Yes, we know that she supports Taiwan independence. Well, she wants to be there to show her support. Is that necessary? Because that will create a serious crisis that will undermine the regional peace and stability, that it could bring China and the U.S., you know, a military-to-military confrontation. Do we need another crisis around the world right now after we have this, you know, current climate change crisis, heat waves around the world, you know, Ukraine war, and food crisis, energy crisis, inflation, etc. Is she that selfish? Is she simply for her political legacy, because midterm elections are coming, and she understands that the Democrats will lose the control of the Congress, the House of Representatives. She will no longer be the Speaker of the House, and the Republicans, one of them, will become the Speaker of the House. So, I mean, at the age of 1982, she retires very soon. So before her retirement, she wants to make some more controversial visit, simply for her political legacy, at the expense of China-U.S. relationship. I just don't understand, you know, why, how can anyone, any politician in that senior position, be that selfish?
Well, let's move on to some of these issues that exist between the two, which many have been emanated from the U.S. in many respects. And William Jones, one of them is interchangeable in terms of the way that the news came out almost back-to-back. It had to deal with the South China Sea and then the military sales that happened to Japan and then Singapore at the same time. Now, these two pieces of news are interchangeable in the sense that I'm going to ask you, where you have China saying that on the South China Sea that the U.S. is making statements regarding this area, but it's distorting the truth. And then it says South China Sea is the common home of regional countries, I'm quoting here, and maintaining peace and stability in the South China Sea is of utmost importance to not only ASEAN countries, but a common demand of China. My question is, are countries in that area actually on board with the U.S. in that aggressive approach towards China?
Well, not entirely. The basic problem is, of course, between the U.S. and China, let's put it mildly, is that the U.S. feels that it now must share or at least discuss with China regarding world affairs, that it is no longer the decider of world politics. And it has been for many years. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States was number one, basically could determine what to do. And that's why they could start the wars in Iraq. They could, you know, do all kinds of stuff in the Middle East and get away with it. Now that's no longer the case. Both Russia and China are major powers. And if the United States had a rational attitude, they would realize that somehow we've got to come to agreement with them. But because they have different systems, so-called, they feel that this would be a loss of prestige. So much of this has to do with that fundamental question. Will the other countries come on board, the so-called allies? Well, you have the solid front, I think, of the Anglo-American crowd, including Australia and perhaps even New Zealand. The Japanese have succumbed to this to some extent, although they have a lot of economic ties with China, a lot of economic interest in China, and maybe they would only go so far. But we've seen over the last few days in the meeting between President Xi and President Widodo in Indonesia, we saw in Wang Yi's visit with the Philippines that these are countries who are around the South China Sea who probably don't have the same outlook as China on that, but want to work together with China to resolve problems, because they feel that by working together, it's to their advantage as well, economically and in many other respects. So I think it's a more difficult call for the United States to pull together a so-called alliance of democracies in the East Asia vicinity, as sure, they have to some extent successfully done in Europe. Even that, though, is not going to hold over a long term either.
Well, Kendo Zhu, you have China coming out making a statement in solidarity with ASEAN countries that is going to further strengthen its cooperation. And at the same time, it will jointly resist all kinds of malicious acts of disruption, as China calls it, and destruction of the South China Sea. So when it comes to ASEAN countries, there's a united stance there, from what it appears, based on the Chinese point of view. China wouldn't come out and say that if it wasn't sure, I'm guessing, I'm asking you, if ASEAN countries were not on board. So isn't there this underlying unity with China, but in the face of the U.S., maybe not admitting to it as much?
Well, the South China Sea issue is interesting. It's complicated, you know, partly because it's a historical legacy. For example, you know, previously people would talk about the Chinese Nandashi land. That was a legacy of the Republic of China before the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. The Republic of China, actually the government, in a sense, is in Taiwan. If you look at the claim about the South China Sea from Taiwan or from the Chinese mainland, it's the same because it's inherited from that time, the previous government. Secondly, so China understands it's complicated. China has put forward this suggestion that is, let's leave aside the differences because, you know, it's about a sovereignty issue. Sovereign claim, it's very difficult to solve that. You know, no country will give up their claim about their, you know, sea waters over there. So let's focus on the working together or the common interests. Let's, you know, jointly develop these resources over there. So in a sense, this is an issue between China, between Vietnam, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, etc. You know, between these countries to find a way to solve this problem. So they are working on this code of conduct, COC, to basically discipline the behavior of every country so we can avoid any differences and focus on the development. But look, about Australia and the US and Japan, including India, they are not say party to the claim of the South China Sea. Frankly speaking, you can say it's none of their business in a sense. But of course you have said, you know, oh, we have the freedom of navigation. You know, freedom of navigation is an idea basically serving the interests of big powers, you can say, for the US probably, partially Russia, China, or India, because for smaller countries, just impossible to navigate a warship, for example, along the Atlantic to the close waters of the United States or European countries. How is that possible? It's fun, but that's also okay. The issue is like, you know, the countries would ask all the countries in the region, China included, they are focused on development, investment, trade. So that's why you have RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, focusing on the development because that's a priority of every country in this region. But look, when the U.S. increased its presence here, it's not about economic presence. It's about a military presence. They send more aircraft carrier. They send more warships. They send more helicopters to challenge China, to challenge, you know, including India, actually. So you can see which country is contributing to the peace and stability, because which is necessary for the development, which country is really creating trouble for the region and for the regional countries.
You were speaking there. I took the time, which I think is very relevant here, William Jones, regarding the number of military bases that the U.S. has in this area in Asia. And I'm very surprised to find this out. I was not aware of this. We know there's roughly about 750 military bases that the U.S. has across the world. But what is surprising here, based on this particular stat, which I can see reflected in a number of sources, that you have, from what it looks like over here, 80,000, up to 80,000 troops that operate from 120 military bases in the Asian territory. So that's about 10%. It's a lot. Does the U.S. then have, because our guests there talked about sovereignty, do the nations that host these U.S. troops not have sovereignty over themselves, especially when it comes to military operations, if directed by the U.S.?
Well, obviously, if the U.S. would deploy these troops in military action, they'd probably be able to do that. The countries could complain about it. But there are agreements that had been made for the stationing of U.S. forces in these areas. Now, what you have to understand, however, is that the United States, which traditionally was not a policeman of the world, after World War II began to follow in the steps of the British Empire. Remember, Franklin Roosevelt wanted to eliminate the British Empire. He didn't want any empire, but he died very quickly. And after that, the general attitude of the so-called policy planners in Washington was that we have to reinstitute the British Empire because if we don't have them in those countries, we will be in a weak position with regard to the Soviet Union. So there was a push to really make the United States into something like a British empire. So you see all these troops deployed, similar to what you had in the British Empire. They were deployed all over the world. And the countries have accepted that fact to some extent, but I think there are very grave concerns at the present moment, especially with the war in Ukraine, which is being promoted and pushed by the United States government, and the very provocative policy in the Asia-Pacific region, that if this goes much further, I think many of these countries that have been friendly to the U.S. and have accepted the fact that U.S. troops would be deployed there would maybe start to rethink that. Okay. Perhaps even Australia, which is an Anglo-American country, they're trying to have a better relationship with China. Maybe they would start rethinking the fact that they are allowing greater deployment of U.S. troops there, because it could be a danger to them.
All right, final question goes to you, Kim Dojuan. And the reason why I'm going to address this question to you is because you're in China. And I want to find out from you, what were your thoughts when a few weeks back at the G20, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order and universal values?
Well, that's an interesting comment. You know, when he refers to universal values, he means Western values, Christian values. Interestingly, basically his idea is like every country should accept that kind of values. I'm not sure every country, you know, in particular, like countries with a splendid history and civilization, like Iran, like China, like Russia, like Egypt, you know, those countries, somehow they have to accept the U.S. values. Isn't that laughable? And secondly, you know, to say China is a threat to this international order. Well, depends on what kind of order we are talking about. If it's about a UN-centered international order, and then China is the strongest supporter of the UN and all the international organizations. The thing is, the international order the U.S. refers to is really an international order that supports the U.S. hegemony, that supports empire, the U.S. empire in which U.S. dictates the global affairs, in which U.S. will enjoy this superiority.
Okay.
The U.S. enjoys the preeminence. With the rise of China, yes, that's a challenge to U.S. hegemony, unfortunately, you know,
okay,
to the
we'll
discredit
have to leave
of Washington.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's Kim Doju. Thank you, senior fellow at Pangol Institution from Beijing. William Jones, thank you for your contribution. Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, VA. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yikova Tawei and the team, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahif al-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn Hussein Zain al-Abidin alayhi as-salam. In verse 1, the Imam seeks refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from number of moral vices. And we got to the part where the Imam alayhi as-salam says to Allah, "O Allah, I seek refuge in you from shakastul khulq, the bad of morals or morality." When we talk about morals and morality, we said we have to understand the true definition of it from the words of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam, he defines morality in three things. He says, husnul khulq, the best of morals, fi thalath, you can find them in three things. One, ijtinabul maharim, avoiding sins. Wa talabul halal, and seeking that which is lawful. Wa tawsi'u ala al-iyal, and spending on your family. So, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, three things he considers them to be the best of akhlaq. One, trying to avoid haram. When he says ijtinabul haram, that is in action and in morals. For example, stealing is haram. Killing a person is haram. Committing adultery is haram. And also, being angry, being rude, being abusive is also haram. Before we continue, let us take a short break, and then we will come back.
A path to salvation. A way to connect.